Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen here, and it is always a treat and an honor to have my friend Gary Phillips with us here at the store.
A pleasure to be had.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about Gary's brand new book, Ash Dark as Night, as well as all sorts of other things, because I know you always have various different projects going. And I was just thinking about it. You know, this is the second book in this new series, the One Shot Harry series, and you know, it picks up in August of '65, and it really documents a lot. You know, there's so much going on in the country and in the city of LA in particular during this time. And I was just thinking, you know, this, you know, the Watts riots kind of kick off, and then 27 years later, it's 1992.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about this book and kind of where it came from.
Well, yeah, it's a good question, Patrick. I mean, I think when you write these books, originally, of course, having now located Harry in early 60s or 63 Los Angeles in the first book, One Shot Harry, I suppose I already knew in my head that I'm going to move forward in time, but there was really probably no way I was going to skip over the Watts riots without having Harry be part of that and be in the middle of that and then have those repercussions from that. And so I thought, so having that notion in my head, it then seemed like a natural then to not just have him be kind of a, he's not a participant, he's not burning down anything, but he's also somewhat a very active observer, because as the opening page indicates, he's right there in the thick of things, recording the events, capturing the events on film, and he captures a particular image then that sets in motion essentially the plot or the things that become revealed in the book as matters develop, as matters go along, as well as in there's several subplots, some of which carry over, particularly his lady friend Anita Clare, and her folks, her kind of crazy folks, and not to give too much away, but pretty much people kind of know this from the first book. They're robbers, they're bank robbers, and so. But Harry doesn't know this, but then she's wrestling with, oh, you know, I really need to tell him this, because at some point we're either going to get caught or killed, and then you know that's going to look bad if I didn't mention it to him beforehand. So you know that's kind of there, and there's some other loose ends, or the other not loose ends, but the other sort of plot threads, some of which carry over, like Harry and his best friend, from grade school. They've had a falling out, and we know why that falling out is from the first book, and that kind of continues here, as well as some other matters that some resolved, some not resolved.
Right. Now, would it be safe to say that this is in some ways a love letter to your father's generation? Although he would have been a little bit older, right?
That's right. Yes, that's
and,
right.
But Harry was, you know, Korean War vet.
Korean War vet. My dad was a World War II vet. And it's funny you ask me that, because it's only, not recently, but it's only fairly recently maybe it occurred to me as I was, not even as I was writing One Shot Harry, but probably when I finished One Shot Harry. And it's certainly my dad or some of my dad's sensibilities show up in other characters over a period of time. But there's a lot of, there's some things about Harry that are very parallel or echo from my dad. And as I've mentioned, I've talked about this many times before, but certainly one of the things I believe that helped to make me a storyteller was the fact that as a kid coming up, because my dad had been out in L.A. since the 30s before he was drafted, and his one brother Sam, Uncle Sammy, was a bartender in the Zanzibar Room, which was the bar in the basement of the Dunbar Hotel. The Dunbar Hotel was kind of one of the hotels that catered to black clientele, where black celebrities would stay when they came to L.A. because of the segregation policies in the city at the time. And so as a kid coming up in the jazz clubs that were on Central Avenue and what have you, so I would hear these stories and Pop and Uncle Sam and then Uncle Norman, the older brother, who eventually came, who was out in L.A. too, who eventually came out to L.A. They sort of hung out there, and they knew people there. They knew some people back from Texas, back from Seguin, their in San Antonio, who had come west to L.A. They hung out, and they knew some of the jazz musicians, that kind of thing. So I would just hear these stories from my dad, you know, when his buddies were over, they're playing dominoes and drinking beer or whatever they're doing. And it just inculcated me as a kid, that and all the Marvel comics I read. But invariably, I think all that then helped to shape a kind of love for this history of Los Angeles, a history that sometimes didn't get talked about or wasn't put in the history books.
Well, yeah, we've read so much about, you know, later 60s, L.A. in particular. But, you know, when you wrote One Shot Harry and it was in 63, I'm like, wow, that's very interesting, you know, because you don't, as you say, you don't read a lot about that particular period in the early 60s, at least that I'm aware of anyway, in fiction. And, you know, now we get into 65 and so much is going on, you know, like the civil rights movement's gaining momentum. Things are really heating up in Vietnam now by late 65 or summer of 65, and that's really looming. You know, the countercultures, you know, starting to take off. There's just so much going on. And, you know, Chief Parker's LAPD is still the force to be reckoned with, right? I mean,
exactly.
And Parker, tell us a little bit about, you know, Parker and his kind of reign. It started in the 30s and went through, it was almost over by the late 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I think he dies of a heart attack, but I can't quite remember when. And to Parker's credit, William Parker, by the way, William Parker was also a decorated World War II veteran. And to William Parker's credit, when he becomes the chief somewhere in the 50s, he cleans up the department in terms of corruption, so that the police department we've seen in on screen a la James Ellroy, right, that department was changed. That department was more militarized. That department was more regimented, was definitely much more... you know, toe the line, be professional. Not for nothing, the man who would become the infamous chief of police in the crack era, Daryl Gates, was at one point Parker's driver.
Is that right? I didn't.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Wow.
But it's also the case that Parker had a very, how shall I say, a patrician view of race relations in Los Angeles. And it is the fact that he actively recruited white officers from the Jim Crow South in ads and gun magazines and in sports, you know, kind of sports magazines, outdoor magazines, as well as newspapers. And so that was reflected in that kind of policing model that Parker brought to bear, as well as then I think in the book I quote Parker exactly, his quote of what he had to say about the rioters and the post-riot situation. So he's a man of some flaws, certainly, but he's also a person who, in fact, help clean up the department and created what becomes now then the modern or the template for the modern Los Angeles Police Department.
Gotcha. Now, during the 50s, he really squared off against, was it Mickey Cohen? He and Cohen had that big war.
Well, and that's been portrayed. You know, the Hat Squad,
yep,
has been shown in various incarnations. But it is a fact that detail of cops did exist, and that when gangsters would come to town, those gentlemen would show them what was what and show them the door.
I see. Right. Now, for those of the people that are watching who haven't, who maybe haven't read the first book, let's just kind of back up a little bit and talk about a little bit more about Harry and who he is. And, you know, you made him a photographer slash kind of a journalist at heart, really, it seems, right?
Yeah, but he's now becoming leaning much more into being a private eye.
Yeah, right.
In the second book, but it is the case that, and again, I've talked about this over time, where my inspiration for Harry were two photographers. One is rather famous, a man named Arthur Fellig, who people will know as Ouija, who was very much on the scene in New York and the five boroughs in the 30s and 40s, and even I think into the 50s. And he was the sort of peripatetic guy, kind of a little guy, cigar smoker, with his hat and his glasses, and he had a mobile film development, lab in his trunk. Of his car. He listened to the police scanner. He'd drive all around. He would capture all these images of a mob robot or some wife, finally getting tired of her husband and putting that butcher knife in the middle of his chest or whatever it was. And in fact, he inspired in the late 50s, I think it lasted more than maybe 2 or 3 years. There was a show called Man with a Camera starring Charles Bronson.
Really?
Yeah. Inspired by Ouija. And there was even, I think it's actually a 1990 film with Joe Pesci. I think it's called The Public Eye. And that film, he's essentially playing Ouija, and it's a period piece.
Is it any good?
That's not bad. I haven't seen it probably since then, but I remember it was okay. I thought it had some plot holes. Anyway, but it's not bad. I mean, certainly Pesci's performance, I think, is pretty good. And so he was on my mind. And then, whatever, years go by, I stumble on an exhibit one time at a museum in L.A., and it's with about Harry Adams. And Harry Adams, I had kind of heard his name maybe a couple of different times before, but he was a freelance photographer, black guy, freelance photographer. It wasn't really a crime photographer so much, but when King or Malcolm X or those kind of folks would come to town or Ali would come to town, he would be there to take their picture and follow them around. And he was, so he's a part-time photographer and a part-time barber. So I thought, well, Harry Ingram, my Harry, will be a little bit different. He'll be a part-time photographer, but he'll be a part-time process server. When we first meet him, he's a process server. And so kind of those two worlds are somewhat parallel. But he's taking photographs for the black press and the slicks. And I create, although again, this is kind of a little bit based on fact, he sometimes works for a black gentleman's magazine, a black playboy called Dapper. And there was actually only for maybe, I think, 4 or 5 issues, there was a black men's magazine called Duke. Okay. And in fact, Ray Bradbury wrote a story for it. I think the story was originally called The Last White Man on Mars. It has a different title, but it's been reprinted several times. Yeah. And so they got some good, writers of some renown, et cetera, to do pieces for, but they just, I don't think could raise the advertising dollars. Anyway, so Dapper is my take on Duke, and I tried to convince, Soho, we should do a fake issue.
Promotional
fake issue of Dapper.
That'd be awesome.
But yeah, it would be awesome. But I think they figured, no, we're not doing that because it'd be sexist and it's expensive. Both of those things, we're not doing this. All right, okay, fine. So all that to say is, though, Harry Adams, Arthur Fellig, Ouija, our influences on Harry Ingram, and not for nothing, the great late great Sam Fuller was also on my mind, the maverick filmmaker, and his trilogy of even though he was a World War II vet, decorated World War II, he did this trilogy of these Korean War films, and so Fixed Bayonets, China Gate, and I'm blanking, Steel Helmet. And of course I've seen them all, and Nat King Cole was actually in China Gate. And anyway, so of course that's in my head. So I said, well, of course I got to make Harry a Korean War vet. but I'm going to have him somewhat haunted from an incident, and kind of give them a grounding and some gravitas. I'm going to then have a minute. Some of these things, you know, I write them down, and they're errant thoughts, and they're sitting in a file, and I got notes and this and that. And sometimes as I'm just coming to the page, it just kind of comes there. I mean, I work from an outline, so there are some notions I have, some notion of what it is I'm trying to do. And then other times it just kind of, you know, you just kind of riff to see where the characters take you. But anyway, all that to say is that that's all in the mix then. And I also knew that because we're coming out of the Red Scare of the 50s and because of my background and people I knew, I actually knew a man, Bill Wheeler, who had been he fought in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, you know, this is before, you know, against the fascists in Spain. This is before World War II or before our entry into World War II. And other people that I knew, some who had come through the Red Scare, who had been teachers and plumbers and what have you, but who had to sign loyalty oaths or had to go and hide their pamphlets in the stuff they were reading and this and that. Anyway, all that is in the swirl in my head, and that I sort of pull out, and then knew that I wanted to infuse that. You know, a little of that's actually always bubbling a bit in, even into Monk in the 90s. But for certain, with Harry being in the 60s, it would be fresh. It would be very current.
Now, did you get on eBay and find copies of all the issues of Dapper? Or Duke. Dapper's your version.
Dapper's my version.
Right.
You can find Duke online.
Can you?
Yeah, I find Duke. Like, there's one issue that has Billy Eckstein on the cover.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. No. No, because I thought, well, if I bought the copies, and I explained that to my wife, and you know, it's a slippery slope.
It's research, honey.
It's research, honey. It's research. So, but I think. As we talk about it now, I'll bring it back up to so on. They will still say no, but I say, come on, man, for the third Harry book, let's do like a little 8-page,
or like
you
a
know,
little pamphlet.
Yeah, a little pamphlet, a little. That's right. Well, yeah, because remember there was Jet Magazine that was digest size, so we could do a digest size special issue of Dapper. But we would have, of course, you know, a couple of cheesecake shots, but then we would really, you know, we'd have some fiction stories.
Right.
And yeah, I guess right. Get some guys we know to write some original pieces for. I think it would be great.
So in this new book, it established really early on, so it's not a spoiler as so much, but he manages to capture kind of in an amazing way, really. The shooting of an unarmed activist. And this guy's name is, I wrote it down, Faraday Zinnum.
Yes.
Now, first of all, was that based on anybody in particular, or was it a kind of a composite?
It's a composite, but it's he's, again, inspired by the real life, he's now the late real life, Michael Zinzin. And Michael Zinzin, as Faraday is part black, part Dene. And Mike was an activist in Los Angeles. And I came to know Michael through the, we worked around police abuse issues. And some years after that, this is real. He lived in Pasadena. A lot of our work was centered in Los Angeles. And as I said, during the infamous era of Daryl Gates. But there was an incident that happened with Michael's, of course, well known to various police agencies. Anyway, he got into an altercation once with some Pasadena cops. They beat him so bad he lost an eye. He sued them, he won. And from that suit, from some of that money, we actually then started a print shop. So anyway, it's all very built. One thing leads to another kind of thing. But yeah, but so Faraday is my homage to Michael.
And so, yeah, he captures this shot, and, you know, of course, the police immediately tackle him and think they're confiscating everything. But he, if memory serves,
he manages to hide the film.
It's a plate.
Harry uses
it's
two
a plate,
different,
right?
It's a plate because he's using a speed graphic. And I shouldn't admit this, but I actually knew this. But in the first book, I get it wrong because the speed graphic doesn't use roll film; it uses plates. I mean, they were flexible plates, but they were still, there's these little plates that you put in the Speed Graphic, because this is the this is the camera he brought back from the war from the dead correspondent, the dead look journalist. And but now, and so, and I got it wrong in the first book, so that's okay. I admit that now. But then I and a friend of mine said, you know, you got that wrong, because he said, because I use the Speed Graphic and I know what I'm talking about. He said, so I corrected it for the second book. And but it was important also because then the cops take, he's got a film camera, he's got a roll film camera with him too, and so they take the roll film thinking, oh, we've got all the film. And so, because he knows this is a plate and he's hidden, and but he's, anyway, he gets beat by the cops, but his intrepid girlfriend, Anita, goes and fetches the film.
Right. And so as a result, you know, he has newfound fame and a bit of notoriety, you know, among the police, and it really puts him under Parker's radar more and more.
Right.
And
that's
then
right.
Can you talk a little bit about the intelligence? I wasn't aware of this. Is it G2? Is that what they're called?
Parker, because he came from the service. Yeah, he called his intelligence operation G2. But it actually has the title. I actually do use the real title in the book, which then becomes the basis for, under Gates, it becomes, let's talk about the lineage first. So it's essentially the Red Squad in the 50s. And then it becomes kind of this intelligence squad, not only because, of course, they were, you know, tracking Reds, but they were also tracking, through the Hat Squad, they were also tracking, you know, gangster elements coming to town. So then as we've talked about, as the civil rights movement and these anti-war movement starts to heat up, also the Free Press makes an appearance, and that was an actual newspaper in the day. And so they're starting to track more activists, Black Panthers, etc. Black Panthers will come on the scene a little later, but certainly the Black Muslims. Certainly the Black Muslims, and starting to track those folks through the intelligence apparatus, which will then eventually become the. And even then, they were starting to plant agent provocateurs, and under the Public Disorder Intelligence Division, which eventually it becomes under Gates, this gets even ratcheted up further.
And you know, Hoover's still around, right? I mean,
yeah,
J. Edgar,
yeah.
Until the early 70s, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. So you mentioned these kind of other threads that are going on in the book. He's hired by a woman who's a friend of his mother.
Anita's mother.
Anita's mother,
yeah.
Right. And this really takes him down, into this whole area that's really interesting in Los Angeles. She hires him to track down her missing business partner.
Right.
This guy named
Mose. Yeah.
Mose Tolbert. Is there anything you can say about that without spoiling anything?
Yeah. Other than it, you know, I wanted obviously a vehicle to set. So you have the incident, as we talked about in the beginning of the book.
Right.
And you have this a la nowadays. Some of these incidents being captured on these things,
yep,
right?
Yep.
But we didn't have those things in those days. We actually had a phone and a wall in those days. but out of that, Harry captures this inciting incident on film. Stark contrast, black and white. And but that incident seems unrelated to what Betty has him doing, but as events happen, they start here and they kind of dovetail. We start to see the strains of one start to then have a echo effect or a parallel effect with what he's looking into in terms of this disappearance of this guy Mose, who was into some shady stuff. So that gets sort of looked at and talked about. But there's other reveals as he goes further into the case.
Right. And you know, and so Harry finds that, you know, hey, he's kind of has a natural talent for this sort of detective work. And, you know, you get a feeling, okay, I can see he's going to be, that opens up a real avenue to explore in future books, right?
I hope so. Or, you know, I it's funny because, you know, we've talked about this, you know, and in fact, I should mention to the audience out here, whoever, when they're watching this months from now, I'm happy that Soho is reissuing the 30th anniversary edition of Violent Spring, my first novel, and the first novel to feature Ivan Monk, who, as you alluded to, his story begins in the aftermath of the events of 92, the other big riot in Los Angeles. So Monk is not in the middle of that riot, but he is, in fact, the reverberations of that are in his case, as are the reverberations of Watts for Harry.
And Monk's father is kind of alluded to in a fun little wink, wink.
Wink, wink. That's right. That's true. That's right. For the careful reader, Monk's dad, the mechanic, shows up in both. He shows up in both books. Yeah, he shows up in both Harry books. So all that to say is that, I'm thinking, you know, I kind of took a break, and like, I'm writing now a heist novel set in modern day, although I'm using a character I've used before. And then when I get back to the third Harry, which I suppose be a, well, I owe them a novella. That's the reason I could do the heist book, because they want book number three. I'm going to do a Harry novella. So somehow that novella will have to bridge what's happening in Ash and then what's going to be the third Harry novel, which I'm not quite clear what that is yet, but I don't know. We'll figure it out. So probably 67, 68, I guess.
Wow, okay. Yeah, you could almost go like 2 months later and pick it up. There's so much going on. Yeah. So
criminal conspiracy unit. That's the unit I was trying to remember earlier, which is what he runs up against.
Okay.
Harry runs.
So you don't really have a long plan. Is it starting to with Harry anyway? Is it just starting to sort of develop in your mind? Do you see could take him?
That's a great. I mean, it's a good question. I'm inclined to say it'll be a trilogy, and then I'll call it a day. But I don't know yet. Yeah, I don't know yet. Because, you know, I've talked about it. At some point I'm going to write that fifth and last Ivan Monk novel. Although that novel, too, will be set in the 90s. Because, you know, when I started out, kind of like, you know, like Mickey's playing Robert Parker, you know, the characters were my age. Now, you can't be no old man running around doing that, man. You give yourself an aneurysm, man. You can't be doing that. What's wrong with you? Like, by the way, not for nothing. When the first Spencer novel, I remember this very distinctly, the first Spencer novel was the God Wolf manuscript. That was written in the 70s. Spencer is a Korean War vet. It is specifically mentioned that he's a Korean War vet. But as the series took off, he became a Vietnam vet somewhere along the line. And then somewhere also, elsewhere down the line, because you couldn't age him, he just was a vet. Just whatever random war we need him to fit into, that's the war he was from. So, but I'm kind of stuck. But I have said that Monk was I think I said he was slightly too young to get drafted, or somehow or another he wound up not getting drafted. But he was in the Merchant Marines, so he did sort of see the world or see some of the world. And also because I think I need to be in the 90s because I need his mentor, who is a World War II vet, Dexter Grant. I need Dexter. Dexter would be even an old man then, but I need him kind of spry and moving around. So I need him. I need it all to happen in the 90s because I'm going to, you know, have some stuff with Dexter and have some stuff with Monk. And there you go.
That'd be cool. Yeah. So do you have what's your idea for that final Monk novel? You mentioned something.
I did mention something to you, which I'm not going to reveal.
Okay.
I sort of have an idea. I mean, I kind of know what kicks it in motion, right? Emotionally, I know what kicks it in motion. I'm not quite clear what the plot is yet, but at some point, I'm getting closer to making that gel.
Oh, wow. Great. Now, let's kind of go down. We got some time. Let's go down memory lane a little bit.
All right.
I always like to give a shout out to your novel, The Juke, which I remember so distinctly when that I got a manuscript of that early on.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is just a pitch-perfect noir.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Do you still get people writing you about that?
Well, it comes up now and then. Yeah, yeah. It gets a mention. And Zelmont Raines, yes. Poor lamented Zelmont Raines. Yeah. So, yeah, it's certainly the only novel I've written. I've written a few short stories in first person, but it's the only novel I've written in first person.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. But as you said, it's kind of the tenor of that story, you know. Yeah. Although Zelmont, by the way, it's kind of in a prequel. Zelmont does show up in a short story in Irish Dublin Noir.
Really?
Yeah, the Kim Bruin edited.
I'll be darned.
For the Akashic series, same as you did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you did Phoenix Noir.
Right. You have to make sure that Eli Craner gets a copy of The Juke. You know, when you guys talk.
That's right.
The football noir.
Football noir, that's it.
Yeah. And also, what about Martha Chaney?
She's funny you should ask. Chaney has now shown up in a comic book form. So there's a longer story short. There's something that used to be something called, well, it's still called Comixology. And it's the computer thing that you kids use that translates physical comics to be read on the computer or particularly on phone. So it'll, like, you can break, like, you'll just see a panel and you can read that and you can swipe to the next panel, that kind of thing, or look at the whole page. And but they're also, so they do that for Marvel and DC and the Dark Horse, the other comics. But they also had a line, although now it's defunct, so Martha just kind of got in under the wire, called Comixology Originals. And a friend of mine was running it then. He's left now, but he started his own. He and the guy who created Comixology, because Comixology is now owned by Amazon, but it used to be an independent business function. So longer story shorter, so Martha Chaney, for those, so now Comixology, I think you used to have the Comixology app. Now I think you can just read the Comixology comics on Kindle. And so there's a Martha Chaney story, Cold Hard Cash. The second issue just dropped. And so there's going to be 5 issues of that online. And then hopefully it'll see a collected print version in graphic novel form.
Wow, very cool. Now, are you doing more in that? Because I know for a while you were doing quite a bit of graphic novel kind of work. Are you still involved in that very much?
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that comics still is part of the siren call that calls to me as a storyteller. Lord knows I would. There's probably more that I'd like to be doing, but not at this moment. Although, oddly, sort of on the flip side of that, so I've gone. So Chaney goes from prose to comics, but I've also done comics to prose with Krista Faust. We wrote the novelization of The Killing Joke, which is a Batman, kind of a classic Batman story written by Alan Moore, and we sort of broadened it out and gave it some dimension. And then apparently, I guess it'll be out sometime this fall, also from Titan Books. A series. They last year they did a Tales of Wakanda anthology. Mm. So different writers wrote different prose stories about the Black Panther and the world of Wakanda, coming from the two big movies. Well, of course, also his presence in comics for decades. And so now they're also doing a essentially it's I don't know if people have been following this in the Marvel universe, but there's essentially two Captain Americas, the original Captain America, and then there's also Sam Wilson, the Falcon, has now become Captain America, which is kind of also old because he became Captain America back in the 70s in the comics. But anyways, the Captain America again now in the new comics, and now there's an anthology of prose stories about, I think it's called The Shield of Sam Wilson, Captain America, something like that. But anyway, so me, Gar Haywood, Chris Chambers, some other folks have written these prose stories about Sam Wilson as Captain America.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened to that? There were a couple of years ago, I think there was a Shaft project that was supposed to get off the ground.
That's right.
That never happened, right?
No, it did. That was David Walker. He worked out a deal with Dynamite Comics, and there was for a hot period of time. He wrote a Shaft novel. In fact, there's a Shaft novel, which I don't know how they marketed or didn't market it.
Huh.
Yeah. Because in Tiedemann's last Shaft novel, he kills Shaft. And in true comics form, David resurrects him. But there's, I think there's like two, three or four issue story arcs that David wrote of Shaft in comic book form, which have been collected now from Dynamite Comics.
Okay.
And he wrote the Shaft novel. I'm blanking on the title, but if you just look up, you know, Shaft and David Walker, it'll come up. But I, for the life of me, I don't know how they distribute or how they, you would think they would have reached out to mystery stores, and as far as I can tell, they did not. And this is a few years ago.
I remember the comics that came out, but wasn't there to be a prose anthology project of Shaft stories?
Yeah, I had David and I were, or I had pitched it to David, and he had, was talking to the guys at Dynamite, and I just don't think they couldn't, at that point, I think they the numbers were not such that they were interested in trying to pursue it further. But as we talk about it, I assume that means that those rights now have reverted back to the Tiedemann estate, and as we talk about it, I might actually try to hunt those down and see if I can pitch that elsewhere. Yeah,
that would be cool. Yeah, the reason I was checking my phone is I got some questions coming in on Facebook.
Oh, there you go.
People
there we go.
That are watching,
all right.
And Renee, who's tunes into a lot of our shows. She says, which character will be in your heist novel? Is this a whole new cast?
No. A few years ago, I say a few years ago because I'm an old man, more than a decade ago. it seems like only yesterday. Lord, these years are getting too close together. Anyway, I wrote a novel called The Warlord of Willow Ridge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the character in that was a guy named O'Connor. And he, at that point, he's kind of he's in his 40s, and he's kind of thinking, well, anyway, you know, the setup is he kind of arrives at this subdivision in Hemet, and his motorcycle he's on is breaking down, so he just kind of goes in there and
squats
because part of the, and because the story had originated because in fact there had been, this is like in like 208, 210, or 208, 209,
right,
as the economic downturn happened, there was this planned subdivision out that way, which had run out of money, and so you had people who had sunk their money into a nice town home, and then, you know, three doors down, there's a skeleton of a house, and it's not been finished, or there's other houses, that people went underwater, whatever. And so that's kind of the territory that O'Connor inhabits. And then subsequent to that, nobody would, unless you, I'm going to explain this, but you have to watch it, all the credits, all the way to the very, very end. Just this, maybe it was in January, or maybe it was in January, there was a miniseries, UK miniseries, which ran on Hulu here, called Culprits.
Hmm.
And it follows these criminals in the aftermath of the robbery.
Okay.
And at the very, very end of Culprits, of the episodes, I think it ran for 6 episodes or 8 episodes. I can't quite remember now. I watched it. It was pretty good, I thought. There's a credit at the very, very end of each show, each episode. It says something about based on source material by Richard Brewer and Gary Phillips. Richard and I, my sometimes crime writing partner, we had conceived a linked anthology called Culprits. The Heist was just the beginning. That came out in 2018, maybe.
Right.
From now, Polis Books, which of course now unfortunately has gone under, which is kind of sad. And the book, O'Connor is the mastermind in the book. And the book follows, the way we set it up, we conceived the plot, we did a kind of mini Bible of the various characters who would be the crew of the heist crew and the villains and such. And then we wrote the main story, essentially chapter one, which kicks off, which is the heist the beginning of the heist and the heist itself. And then we brought in several other writers who had chosen a particular character from the heist, and they wrote a chapter about that character. And then we then edited to have consistency, and then we then wrote the final chapters to tie everything up. Now, this is Tales of Hollywood, right? Because on Sunday, in fact, I'm doing a for SoCal MWM, hosting a panel where we talk about books and TV writers and book writers and TV writers, because I've now written in both mediums. How this UK production, and these guys did, you know, they did, one of the producers did Killing Eve, and the overall guy, he's had several shows on. My agent didn't sell it to him. My manager didn't sell it to him. We have no idea how they, was it one day the intern came into the office and they said, go find us a heist novel somewhere, you know, and we, and only the basic structure, which is, but it's, this is, by the way, this is true of every heist novel, which is you set up the heist happens, and something goes wrong. I mean, that's kind of the structure of every Parker book. I love Parker book, but every Parker, you know, because otherwise you don't have a story. Because if you just skip off with all the money, well, then we just skipped off with all the money. So, but they paid us, and we split the money with we split half. Me and Richard split half, and then and the other half we divvied it up equally among the writers. So anyway, all that's a long story to tell you that O'Connor has now appeared in his own novel, this linked anthology novel. He's also in a couple of short stories, and now he's the mastermind in this novel called The Hall. And I'm not giving anything away by telling you the premise of the story, because it's kind of right there in the beginning of the book. Is people may know now a lot of the one percenters, or maybe it's the 1% of the one percenters. Or 1% on up, or 1%, however that works, are into survival shelters, but very swank. You know what I mean? In the old days, they were converting missile silos, right? But that's, you know, any chump can buy one of, get a room in one of them things. We're talking about things that like for instance, Zuckerberg has a 5,000 square foot
Hawaii, right?
Yeah, Hawaii. Survival shelter underneath the thing he's building on top of it, including feeding his cows beer and macadamia nuts, I guess.
He's serious.
Yeah. And so in my story, the basic plot is there's an inside person, but you have to read the book to see the inside person. But basically, O'Connor and his crew are going to rip off one of these survival shelters because, of course, my assumption is that these folks would secret away cash.
Lots of good stuff down there.
Yeah,
right?
Diamonds and gold, as if, by the way, that would help you when society has collapsed, but you might as well do something with it. And so, of course, they get through this inside person. They figure out this one shelter has this stuff secret away, and they're going to knock it over.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, with technology today, it's got to be really challenging to write a heist novel.
Yes, it is. Well, it's funny you should say that, because you're right. Knocking it over is not the big thing. It's the aftermath that counts.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you see that in modern espionage. You know, it's like, and Barbara talks about this a lot, where there's been a real return to like old school trade craft.
Yes.
You know, like leaving little notes and trees,
right,
and stuff, you know.
That's right. That's right. That's right. To circumvent. Exactly. Well, no, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, well, it's great that you mentioned that, because in this novel, in the Hall, O'Connor, I mean, he's up of a certain age, but O'Connor also is like, he just has dead drops. Cause right. I mean, he uses some of that tech stuff. There's a person in there who knows this stuff, but he doesn't trust that stuff. So yeah, he uses dead drops and some of the old fashioned stuff to communicate.
Let's see here. people like the jet sized
Idea for Dapper. I'm gonna pitch that to Soul.
Definitely.
And I can decide. Which are mostly women there, so that's gonna go over great. It's gonna
all
go
right,
over
Juliet,
big, baby.
Juliet, yeah, you heard it here first, right? Okay, Stefania, who's a Italian lady, really cool person, always tunes in. She has some questions. She says, this is a big question, actually. How did crime novels change through the years, in your opinion?
well, it's funny. We all have to go to sleep soon, so.
That's a big question.
That's a big question. Well, we can answer very briefly.
Yeah.
All right. Very briefly, as you well know, there's a gulf is not the word, but there's a bridge. That's a better word. There's a bridge from Spillane to Mosley. Well, somewhere along that bridge there's a bridge from
Hammett to Chandler
to McDonald. No, Hammett to Chandler to Spillane, Spillane to McDonald, McDonald to Gar Haywood, Walter Mosley, me, Paula Woods.
Don't forget Himes.
And that's right. And that's
major.
Thank you. So there's a it's Spillane to Himes. You're right. You're absolutely correct. It's Spillane to Chester Himes. Exactly. Right. So all those are kind of different takes on the crime fiction genre, and yet in some ways they build one on the other.
Right. I mean, yeah, we could pontificate forever on this subject because there have been so many little trends over the
That's
years,
right.
and certain types of crime novels come right. into fashion.
Oh, and I should, and I, how can I not mention the Brandstetter, the
Joseph Hansen
books,
yeah.
the sort of the gay, although there had been some gay privatized, Feral Love actually comes to mind, but certainly. Hansen with the Brandstetter books.
We just did one for our discussion group.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
And there was, even then, back then, John Huston was going to make a Brandstetter.
Is that right?
Yeah. But the studio got.
We read the first one, which was called Fade Out.
Yeah.
Which seemed like a classic California.
And I think that it might have been then Fade Out because it might have been the first one. But the studio eventually just got. Queasy. They just got cold feet, and then I thought I had heard recently, or more recently, that there was some renewed interest because I should also mention this. Soho was also has reissued.
That's right.
The Hansen books.
That is right. Yeah, I mean, do you think it's kind of safe to say that the crime novel obviously reflects the times that you're in? And, as you go through certain eras in history, all of a sudden you go through the late 60s and then into the 70s, all of a sudden the cops aren't the good guys, and like the Richard Stark is a prime example
right.
of that, the bad guy is actually the anti-hero.
The hero, that's right.
I know. Snore. Sorry.
No, that's right. No, you're right. No, I agree.
Okay, let's see. Well, this is good. Stefania also asks, have you ever thought about writing a book of a different genre than yours? But that's a trick question because you write in all kinds of different genres.
But answer your question, yes, I've written some pulp. Matthew Henson and the Ice Temple of Harlem.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that.
And dabbled some a little bit in sci-fi. There's the unvarnished collection of mine, sort of sci-fi.
Yeah.
There you go, baby. Pulp stories as I'm being chased. By the Aztec demon queen as I'm driving a 41 Willis, baby, along the streets of Venice when Venice was slum by the sea. But yes, at some point I want to really stretch and write that sci-fi novel. Although invariably, it's going to have some crime fiction elements. I probably just can't stay away.
Here you go. You'll like this. Mr. Phillips, are you a singer too? You have a beautiful voice.
Thank you, but no. It is a true family trait. We can't hold a note.
And then finally, what do you think? Okay, have you seen the film based on Percival Everett's book?
Yes.
American Fiction. Yeah, she says, I'm from Italy and I can't really understand this controversial topic. I would like your opinion on it. That's a good question.
Again, we don't have that kind of time.
Yeah.
Maybe she should read the original.
Erasure. Great book.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go into a breakout session on that topic.
There
right.
We go.
Right. Yeah.
Almost a historical novel, and I'm wondering what kind of gears you have to change in your brain to go like before computers. You're writing before computers.
Right.
You're writing now. Is that an easy thing to go back and forth?
Generally speaking, it is. Jim, only. I mean, even I was a kid then, but God knows, being weaned on all these old films, you know what I mean, and even today, what's the old folks channel? MeTV and MeTV Plus. You know, I'm watching, you know, original Hawaii 5-0, Police Woman. I mean, it's a little later, but you know what I mean? But yeah, but the idea that you see these images of like
Mod Squad,
you know, people use, you know, a electric typewriter. Oh my God. You know what I mean? You know, and, push button, phones and such. So that's not so tough. As I don't try to, for instance, I don't try to overly use slang from that era, because then it does sound corny or sounds like pastiche, and it doesn't come off well, you know? I use a little bit of it because I think people would talk that way. But it, you know, you can't, you know, there was that, like, episodes of, you know, 77 Sunset Strip where Cookie is talking in beat or whatever he's talking in, you know, or you watch, there's a couple of great old episodes of Peter Gunn, and one of the reoccurring characters, or one of his snitch characters, because he was always, you know, seeing these different kind of, one of them was Billy Barty, which was great, right? It was the pool shark. But he had, yeah, Billy Barty was a pool shark, but he had to have a this wooden box he'd step up on to shoot pool. And one of the other characters was this cat. I forget the guy's name. He does have a name, but he's like a beatnik impresario. Like, he owns like a coffee house shop or something like that. He's because you know, Gunn falls in to get, you know, find out what he needs to find out. But sometimes this guy would speak in that kind of, you know, early 60s beat argot.
That, a lot of bongo drums.
Bongo drums and stuff like, I think it's great. You know, even then they're making fun of it, but you know, it kind of is of its time. But you can't go too far. But although there is, in Ash, there is a happening, right? There is. So some of that does filter in because it did exist and it did go on.
A hootenanny?
Not a hootenanny. Not so much a hootenanny. It's more like a gathering, like a happening. This is actually before they started to use the term happening, but it is kind of what that is, and that's how he stumbles into one of the other people that he's looking, periphery person he's looking for, who's not periphery, as we find out. But yeah, but I thought that'd be kind of, because the Free Press did exist, and so I thought, well, okay, it makes sense that we would have something like that in that part of West Hollywood. And I should mention, by the way, the Free Press, it's not here in the book, it's well, very subtle. The Free Press actually was sued out of existence because they, in fact, one of the reporters somehow then got a list of undercover narcs.
Really?
Yeah, and their lawyers said, you can't, don't publish that. And Art Kunkin, the publisher, to his credit, said, damn that, and he published it. And, of course, the LAPD sued him, and they sued him out of existence.
Wow, man. You know what's crazy? Looking at some of the Dragnet episodes from the late 60s, when they get into the hippie era, you know, and they start talking about LSD, yes, and all that, yes, kind of stuff. Yes. With Jack Webb, that's great.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, before we wrap it up, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Snowfall. And the TV show, and John Singleton. Did you ever meet Singleton?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I got hired.
Okay. Well, of course. I know. What was he like?
He was very secure. I didn't really know John well. We had met over a period of time. We would run into each other now and then. So then when the show started, you know, Walter was always on the show. And then John was on the show. John was one of the creators of the show. somewhere between the second and third, but I never really, you know, like I didn't really bug Walter about it, this and that. But in my heart of hearts, you know, this show right up my alley. And I liked the show. I liked the show from the beginning. I was a fan of the show. And, man, when the call came, I just – it was just great. It was so wonderful. I worked in that show for 4 years. And just the idea that, man, we could take those characters on that journey and wind up where we wound up and also make a statement about what crack did to South Central and this and that. It was just heartfelt, man. It was just a wonderful experience.
Was that your first experience writing TV?
Yes. I have had, over the period of time, I've had a couple of my books. Actually, Violent Spring was optioned many years. When Violent Spring first came out, it was optioned by HBO. But I didn't get to write the script. Because they said, who are you? We're not going to write the show. But I went through that whole process, so it was kind of interesting to go through the development process. Director was attached, and finally a writer was attached. And then I've had a short story option. I've had a couple of my I've had a graphic novel option. So I've always had, and I've pitched out and then. So I've always had a little toehold, a little taste of Hollywood, mostly option money. Maybe I've written a couple of different treatments. Actually, I've written a treatment for One Shot. I'm trying to hawk that now. Treatment, which is to say you take the book, and I certainly take liberties with some things in the book to create this kind of six-episode arc for Harry. So different than the book, although there's a flashback to Korean War. In the book, we start at the Korean War. A la Sam Fuller, we start, you know, right on action. But it was definitely the first time I was in the writer's room, yes.
What was that experience like? Did you enjoy, you know, going from writing by yourself, you know, in front of a computer, collaborating with other people? Did you enjoy that process?
I did, but yeah? I knew what to expect, having had friends of mine like Bob Ward, who'd been a showrunner on Miami Vice, and other folks that I knew who had worked in TV and writing and went into books or doing both. So I had some sense of that experience or some sense of what that was like. And I have to say now, but I've also heard, you know, horror stories about showrunner, you know, the person who's like the head person who has to eventually make it, you know, because these are not democracies. You're contributing ideas to how we're going to move the story forward or what this character does. But in the end, somebody's got to make a decision, because otherwise you just got too much stuff floating around. But our showrunner was very low-key and very – I mean, he took all that stuff in. And you know, we sometimes get the loggerheads in that room, man. But
yeah,
you got to wade through all that. And at the end of it, try to pull out what is pertinent and what – you want to use to make that story happen.
Would each of the writers kind of bring their own, you know, take the lead, as it were, on specific episodes?
Well, eventually, yes, because once then we've kind of talked about all this stuff, and some of this stuff is now up on the board, or eventually we just we're on Zoom, so it's up on the virtual board, but the board that we would still share. Then either a writer or writers were assigned to then essentially come up with the outline, and then everybody would read the outline, everybody critiques the outline, and then you go away and you write the full script.
Gotcha. Right. Well, any other news in Gary Phillips' world that we need to know about?
No, not particularly, other than, I mean, I've talked about The Hall, which I'm looking forward to that seeing the light of day, and other than I'm just kind of sweating, already in the back of my mind, sweating what's going to be this Harry novella that takes us from Ash to probably what will be the third full Harry novel.
Sounds great. Well, Gary, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. And it's good to see you again, man. We like I said, we've seen each other
zooming
for a while, but
couple
it's,
years.
I haven't been back to Scottsdale in a while, so it's great to show up.
Yeah, and thanks everybody for tuning in.
That's right. That's it. Thank you, folks.
Signed copies available. So anyway, thanks so much.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.